Acclaimed integrative medicine expert, Dr. Holly Lucille.
Think well, act well, be well.
Inherently you.
Yes, folks, it is Dr. Holly Lucille here at the Inherently You podcast, being congruent with our heart, our heads, and our hands to help us think well, be well, act well. You can go to inherentlyyou.com to find out more about that. But listen, I want so much to bring up our guest today. This show is going to be so amazing because it's all about the nature fix. Why nature makes us happier, healthier, and more creative. I have the lovely Florence Williams with me. She is the author of that book that is about to drop February 7th. She is a journalist and contributing editor to Outside Magazine. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, and National Geographic, among others. Her first book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, was New York Times Notable Book of 2012 and the winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Science and Technology. Florence, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Holly. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, so like I said, I have your book in front of me and started to read it. It's such a lovely read. And I have to say, the book just looks, it's calming. It's got these colors and it looks great and it feels great. It's this hardback book. And I'm so excited to continue reading. And where and when did you develop your love for the outdoors?
It's a funny story. I actually grew up in New York City on the Upper West Side, surrounded by a lot of asphalt, and I lived on the 11th floor. I didn't even have so much as a window box. So in a way, it's sort of strange, but maybe I knew I was nature deprived because I found myself gravitating to our city park. Central Park was a few blocks from my house.
Sure.
And I loved it. And I was always, begging my parents to take me biking or picnicking, and I would climb trees and run around. And actually, my dad also turns out he's kind of a wilderness fanatic. So I was fortunate that in my later childhood, my adolescence, teens, I started going on long wilderness canoe trips with him every summer. So I had this weird sort of urban life in the winter and very kind of wildernessy life in the summer. And I'm still trying to mesh those.
Wow. Well, that's fascinating. It makes me think of, I think it was it Richard Louv? He wrote The Last Child in the Woods, and he coined that term nature deficit disorder.
That's right. And it's a term that I come back to a lot because I feel like it's just intuitively it seems real to me that when I'm deprived of nature, I feel myself responding to that in ways. And that's partly what led me to want to write this book about it.
That is lovely. I was just having a conversation with a colleague of mine when we were, for some reason, he and I are both seeing so many more children and at younger ages coming in diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, et cetera. And it made me think about NDD, that nature deficit disorder, because I feel like these days with children, we are not, I used to play shoot, kick the can and ding dong ditch them and all that stuff outside and had to be in by the time the sun was setting. And, our kids aren't getting outside anymore because they're got their 3x5 worlds and their little smartphones and things. And so I think that's having a huge implication on how their brains are developing and their health overall.
That's right. I think we're in the middle of experiencing a really profound mass migration indoors. And it's something that's gone very unremarked upon as our society has done this. And it's really significant. It has profound implications. And I have some statistics about it. For example, 71% of today's mothers said that they recalled playing outdoors every day as children. But only 25% of them say their kids play outdoors daily.
Oh my gosh. That is, I love it, that mass migration indoors. I've seen it. And I have to tell you something. The other week I was down on the beach and, all the families and walking around and it was New Year's. It was actually over New Year's. And this family was walking. There was a toddler that was actually walking, but that there was a I would say an infant, not an infant, maybe a baby. I can't categorize the age, but they were in a stroller, right? So still you're outside and you have the ability when you're a baby to look around and, you know, like these are my toes and these are my fingers and these are the other people that are walking by and that's the, you know, ocean and those, that's the sand. But this kid in his stroller had a phone. Yeah. Outside, but I was like, oh no. I mean, it was all I could do to not just go up and go, hey, you know, there's so much development that could be happening right now. There's so much creativity that could be spinning around in that child's brain. I'm like, please, please, please. And I was like, oh, well, they weren't in a restaurant. They didn't need to be, you know, have the kid detracted by anything. You know, it was like, it was one of those things where I was just like, oh my gosh. And so, even the mass migration to electronics, even when they're outdoors, it was like just kind of crazy to me.
Wow. Yes. I just on that note, I did run across a term that I think is really pertinent by a sociologist, and it's containerized kids.
That
our kids are like in little containers all the time. They're in car seats. They're in strollers. They're parked in front of a TV or a device. They're plunked in chairs, even in kindergarten.
Yeah, wow.
And this has really strong implications for their gross motor skill development, you know, even their kind of long-distance vision. You know, if they're just constantly looking at something in front of them, you know, they're not getting enough vitamin D into their retina. They're just amazing things happening that people aren't really talking about.
You know, and I think it's important to note those things because as in my field and in my practice, I start to see things that are usually related to age—they're age-related diseases, cognition, decrease in cognition, or even macular degeneration—and then I see these things being called. There are new categories like early onset, and I'm thinking we can't just create a new category of sick people. We have to keep asking the questions why, and I think these questions are so important, and some of your discoveries are so important too. So this, like I said, the Nature Fix, why nature makes us happier, healthier, and more creative. It's launching on February 7th, and I see in your book that you examine kind of natural environments all over the world, but you're from the United States, right?
I am from the United States, and we here have, you know, a particular sort of orientation toward nature, and other countries have different ones that I found to be sort of perspective shifting and revealing. For example,
tell me about that.
Yeah, I traveled to some Asian countries where the relationship to nature, you know, is just different. You know, here we have the sort of Judeo-Christian, you know, dominance of nature, and we think of ourselves as separate from nature. But nature is much, much more integrated kind of into the daily, everyday lives of people in other parts of the world. And I was really interested in how Japan is actually kind of medicalizing nature to the point where they're recommending it and almost prescribing it for their highly stressed out, especially Tokyo residents. Tokyo is this incredibly densely populated, kind of stressful city with a also very high stress work culture. And yet the Japanese researchers are sort of at the forefront of studying what happens to our physiology, what happens to our nervous systems when we go into the forest, even for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and they're documenting how our blood pressure can drop, our heart rates decrease, even our cortisol levels drop, which can be a marker for stress. And then there are also a lot of kind of self-reports that people, you know, they're doing questionnaires, and people are reporting, you know, feeling happier moods or less feelings of anger and anxiety after a 30-minute walk in nature.
Wow. I can imagine if we can just get people to do that. Now you say also in your book that a 15-minute walk in the woods causes measurable changes in physiology. Have you found that different natural environments yield different physiological and psychological benefits across the board?
Well, that's kind of one of the more kind of granular questions that I think researchers would like to answer, but they're not quite there yet. And they're curious to know, for example, right, like, do bodies of water make us feel differently?
I was thinking about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think some of it is individual and some of it is cultural. So there are some people who are just never going to really feel comfortable, you know, in a vast desert landscape. You know, it will feel too unprotected or too exposed. Or other people are not going to feel comfortable, you know, in a deep forest where there are a lot of bugs, for example. So I think there is some individual variation here, you know, and I think by and large, you know, most people know which kinds of landscapes they gravitate to, whether they, you know, love to be in a garden or whether they love to be on the beach. You know, so many people are so attracted to coastal environments.
Yeah, you're right. It is very individual. You know, sometimes I coach CrossFit actually as a hobby here, and you know, we asked a question during the, you know, sort of getting the seeing who you're sweating with, and the question that I asked the other day is mountain or ocean, mountain or ocean, and people had very, very resolute and distinct just that answer to that question, whether that was
exactly.
Mountain or ocean.
And I think we have to acknowledge too that there are some people who just don't like nature. You know, and they'll feel happiest and comfortable, you know, on a rooftop in the middle of the city.
Well, and I think that's to be respected too, because, right, everybody's individual. I know that for me, you know, anytime that I'm sort of working with somebody who has a lot of that sympathetic activity going on, that fight or flight, even from a primal perspective, not necessarily, you know, I don't think we have the luxury of actually being in danger most these days, you know, and there's not a bear running after us or the locusts aren't coming to, you know, rob our crops or what have you, but we have this primal brain that's always on fire as far as just that fight or flight. And a lot of times, you know, my prescription is, you know, for everybody, I think it's different, but where is that parasympathetic place? Where is that place where you can actually break that loop of sympathetic activity and rest and relax and repair? And, you know, for some people, for me, definitely it's getting outside. Living here in Los Angeles, it's even seeing the black crows that are on my, you know, the rooftop next door, or, you know, a squirrel on the wire. You know, it just anything in nature for me. It just reminds me of how simple things can be. Reminds me to take a couple deep breaths. I think it's why I always have animals, so I have an excuse to get outside as much as possible. But you're right;
That's
it
right.
is different for everybody.
It is, but I think an important point is that, you know, while some of us can calm our nervous systems in a museum or at a concert, what's so great about nature is that it's this very accessible, kind of free solution. You know, talking about people who live in cities, you know, city parks are something that, you know, have this tremendous public health benefit just because so many people can be helped by them. And so while nature isn't the only sort of environment that could make us feel good, it is this tremendously powerful, inexpensive, and easy to access one.
Now, so because you mentioned, you know, your love of nature and your love for outdoors, even though you grew up in New York City, are people, in your research, did you find that civil and state governments can do things, adapt the existing urban environments to make them more nature-friendly for folks to have access to everything that you're talking about in the book?
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the demographic trends I point out is that we are now an urban species, and more people globally live in cities than don't live in cities. This is something that changed in about 2008. One person has even proposed calling us Metro Sapiens. I know, isn't that terrible? But
that's
given
amazing.
The fact, right, and the reality is that most of us do live in cities. So I wanted to go to a kind of a city of the future, you know, that had sort of tackled this question and tried to figure it out. And so I went to Singapore, which is, you know, really one of the most densely populated cities in the world. But Singapore also has had this tremendous commitment to nature and to sort of greening the city. And so it was fascinating to go there and see what some of the policies are that they have in place. And one of them is that when a developer builds a new building, typically a high rise, because that's what most of the buildings are there, they actually have to more than replace the greenery that they disrupted. And so not only do they have rooftop gardens, but they also have vertical gardens that crawl along the outside walls. And these are gardens that, you know, butterflies can use and birds can use and people living in neighboring buildings can look at and kind of, you know, be calmed by. And then there are also these tremendous channels and avenues and corridors that connect their different parks. The public housing projects have courtyards, lots of greenery. So it is possible to live in a city and also benefit from nature.
Yeah, you know, because, you know, some of the quotes in the praise for your book, Mary Roach says it's illuminating, surprising, clever, and important. And I think it's important because I do think that this increasing, you know, disconnection we have from nature and being metro sapiens. You know, I think it's having its consequences. I'm certainly seeing it, and of course, where I'm seeing it is in folks' health and how they're presenting clinically, and like I said, younger and younger and younger. And I do think this is important, and I guess I want to ask you, how can people, what is your advice for folks, because we have such a modern day lifestyle, the electronics, the digital life. It's something I know my family and I struggle with as far as boundaries and how do we, you know, break that cycle of just being so addicted to checking our phones and stuff. What do you tell people? What did you find in your research? How do you help people sort of create a balance where this is concerned?
Yeah, I did get a lot of useful sort of practical recommendations from scientists that I interviewed. And among them, this is funny, in Finland has a pretty depressive population. You know, they have long, dark winters. They drink a lot. Even though the Scandinavian countries are sort of high in happiness index, they also have a sort of paradoxical, sort of depressive tendency. And right. Health experts there are actually recommending, very specific, which I think is funny, 5 hours a month of time in forests. You know, and that translates to a little over an hour a week. So, right. You know, and you don't have to be walking or exercising. You know, you can just be sitting or picnicking. But they really have found through their studies that people who spend 5 hours a month as a minimum can really work hard towards preventing depression. I thought that was kind of interesting. And then I spoke to someone in Japan who thinks that we really need sort of a weekend a month, if we can, in a more natural environment that's less stressful. And also many of these people also recommend that while we're in these environments to really turn the cell phones off or turn the ringers off, really try not to use them because the data also shows that when we use our cell phones, we're not engaged, right, with the world around us. And so there are things we don't notice. We won't see the beautiful bird in the tree or we won't see the fractal pattern, you know, that can sort of tickle our perceptual senses and release dopamine in our brain. So there are these opportunities we're not getting when we're on the phone.
Yeah, I think, and it's so important. This information is so important. So this book is available February 7th. Right? I want everybody to get it and read it because I do think it is extremely important. And I do think that there are consequences because it's such a paradox because we have all of these modern day devices to keep us more connected and we're getting increasingly more disconnected. And I see it affecting families. I see it affecting relationships. I see it affecting people's relationships with themselves. You know, even being able to go out to dinner and just not have your phone on the table, right? Or sometimes I glance around at the restaurant and see, you know, two people sharing a meal, but not really, because they're both individually, you know, on their phones.
Yeah, and this is another great...
Go ahead. Please, go.
This is another great sort of concept about being in nature and being outside, which is that while our technology divides us, when we're outdoors, it seems to connect us. And this is something the research has shown, too. Social relationships, social connections are actually facilitated by time outdoors, whereas time indoors disrupts them.
Wow, that is amazing research, and I am not surprised. You know, there's a group of us that we try to get outside every other Saturday and play some touch football. And I look forward to it so much just, yeah, because you're running around and it's definitely social. And then we go try to grab, you know, a bite to eat afterwards. And it's just so nice to have built into my life because other than that, I'm sure I'd be at my computer doing something, looking it up, writing something. And it is so nice to have that break because I honestly think once we get in it, it's hard. It's like any other sort of dependency or addiction that there is almost a downregulation of your receptor sites from the stimulation that you get from the constant checking or the emails or the texts and the things that come through. I know that sometimes each year I'll take myself up into, usually up in the Oregon area, like the Mount Hood or Three Sisters, and go out backpacking. And, you know, I have to say I do bring my phone because it's with me and I don't want to leave it in my car. And I'm surprised that I'm looking for reception sometimes. You know, it's been about 24 hours and I feel like I'm going through a small withdrawal.
Right, right.
But when I resolve to actually calm that down. But there is this sense, even though I know better, right, there's my question to me that, like, why can't I just, you know, let this go? What are the consequences of that? What am I about to feel? And I really test myself with that. And I encourage folks. That's what my community Inherently You is all about. It's like, why do we do the things we do when we know we shouldn't be doing them? And not to stop doing them, but get really curious about that disconnect, you know, that incongruent place in, like, you know, who wants to be that rabid, you know, sort of Pavlov in your pocket, I heard somebody say the other day, right? So it's like that right, constant totally. Stimulation that we get from checking our phone. Yeah, it's
well,
tough.
I think that's
it's
one
really
of the
tough,
benefits.
But it's,
yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the benefits of the wilderness, you know, is that often we don't have reception. And sometimes we have to
right.
remove the temptation altogether, right? So I think that's one of the great appeals and benefits of being in a more remote landscape. I mean, I know I send my kids to summer camp. I'm fortunate to be able to do that. And they're not allowed to have any devices. So, you know, how many preteens can actually, you know, say that they're not looking at a phone for 5 or 6 weeks? It's a tremendous benefit that I really wish more kids and more adults could experience. But, you know, one thing about the book is that I divide it by dosage. So first I talk about sort of nearby urban nature. But then I talk about the sort of intermediate steps of, you know, actually spending more intentional time in parks or reserves. And then I spend the last third of the book really talking about the wilderness, because the research shows and the data shows that really profound things can happen to your brain when you're out of your normal sort of stressful environment for many days at a time. In fact, there's a neuroscientist who has this phrase, he calls it the 3-day effect. And what he sees is that when people spend, you know, 3 or 4 days in nature, they really start to think about their self-concept and their hopes and their dreams, you know, who they are, who they want to be. It's time for deep reflection that we don't get anywhere else in our lives.
Yeah, I can tell you it's true. When I come back from being out there, I feel like a different person. Now I slip back into my normal routine.
Yeah,
in
you slide
time,
back in.
But it's at least. It's at least nice to take a break. Okay, one more question for you, and then I want to tell people where they can find out more about you. Is there a particular activity that actually makes you feel connected to nature?
Well, I am a river runner, and there's nothing like floating on a river for me. I feel like it's like the metaphor for everything. You know, you have to
pay
attention. Things are coming at you, and you have to react. It requires your full attention, and I get into this kind of state of flow. Sort of just the right amount of attention, but it's not usually completely freaking me out because I stay off the really, really huge rapids. So
right.
for me, that's kind of my favorite playful, fun, and social environment. It, you know, it checks all the boxes. But that one really checks all the boxes for me personally.
That I love it. I mean, even that you can say flow in there, you know, like that,
right,
just the,
right.
the flow. That's awesome. Well, all right. So once again, your book coming out February 7th, The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, More Creative. I think it's extremely important read. I think the messages in there, your research, the data is there, and it's so important. And to understand the consequences of things that, you know, you say, the container kids and our mass migration inside, and understanding what effect that's having on our development and our health. So folks, you can find out more of about Florence at florencewilliams.com. I want to thank you so much for being here. Everybody, if you want to, you can run over to iTunes and go ahead and rate the podcast, so we want to grow our community that way. Thank you so much. It's Dr. Holly signing off. We will talk to you next time.